1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 question. By the last day, this box is not big enough to hold all the questions. Anyway, see what we've got here. And please, I hope you're all keeping the silence rule, because you can see this is a statue over here, the fellow on the cross. That's a warning in case you break the silence rule. No, we don't go that far. Okay, here comes the first question. Oh, this is an easy one. May we have the window open in the meditation hall, please? That's a very, very deep question. Because it's always, some people want the window open, some people want it closed. And there's advantages on both. You get the wind coming in, but also, can you hear this okay? You get the wind coming in, but also you get the mosquitoes coming in. So whenever you want comfort in the world, there's always something to pay for it, which is one of the problems. So this is why the best thing is that windows open, windows closed. If it's open, it can be open. If it's closed, it can be closed. If it's hot, it's hot. If it's cold, it's cold. And that way, we develop what's called the non-fault-finding mind. And let someone else decide. They want to open the window, fine. If they want to close the window, fine. If it's open, it's open. If it's closed, it's closed. But as you, as a meditator, you just allow it to be. In other words, you don't sort of think, oh, it should be open. Because I remember Ajahn Chah at his hut once, somebody was saying, oh, we should have cushions to sit on. Because in those days, they didn't have cushions. And he started, yeah, as soon as you get cushions, the next thing you want is these benches. And after the benches, the next thing you want is these chairs. And then you want lazy boy chairs. And in the end, you'll ask to have beds to recline on while you're listening to the Dhamma talks. And of course, it doesn't really get that far. But what he was really meaning is that, oh, sometimes, how comfortable can you get? Because if we go to the path of trying to make it more and more and more and more comfortable, then, you know, we need, you know, the air conditioners, but everybody with their own remote control. You know, we're building this retreat center where in our, just opposite our monastery. And I was thinking, actually, the perfect retreat center would be when everyone could have like a zone, like an air-conditioned duct right above you, with your own remote control, so you can decide your temperature. And you can have these like little zones just coming down right around you, so it doesn't really affect the person sitting next to you. So if you like it cold, you can have cold. If he likes it hot, you can have it hot. Wouldn't that be wonderful? In your dreams, as they say. So, when it said here, may we have the window open, what it really meant, may I have the window open. So I'm sure you haven't done a survey of everybody else whether they want it open or not, but we always assume that what I want, everyone else wants, and of course that's really not true. So the best thing though, that you can open the real window, which is not the window out there, open up the window into your mind. And when you open up the window inside, to go deep inside of yourself, you don't even feel the heat or the cold or the insects or whatever. And that's the real window to open up. The window into the mind, into the jitta. So, you have my full permission to open up that window. And once you can open up that window into insight, into freedom, then you don't need to open up any other windows at all, anywhere in the world. Okay? That's the answer to that question. You see, I managed to spit it out. But really, what you do, the secret is to come here before anybody else, and then you can open it up before anyone's sitting here. Next question, a real question. Dear Ajahn, does the practice of meditation, apart from retreat time, result in one being withdrawn and aloof from one's friends, even those who were close previously? How do we handle this type of social problem? Problem, I think it's a great thing to be aloof from all your friends. They just end up messing around and getting you into trouble anyway. No, just see what happens naturally. Sometimes that there comes periods in your life just when you want to be a bit withdrawn from your friends. And that's fine, that's actually nature. Sometimes your meditation's going really well, and you know, you've got things to do by yourself. Fine, be withdrawn. But usually fine, you're withdrawn from a while, and then later on, especially when you start to develop loving-kindness meditation, you can actually go back into society again. So you can do both. You know, just like me, there's times when I just go 6 months without seeing anybody. And other times when you're in front of 10,000 people giving a talk. So, you know, I have both extremes. You know, being a star and then just being a nobody, just disappearing into nothingness. So it really is that these are times of your life when it's good to be aloof. And if they're real friends, they really are loved ones, they can understand you and say, yeah, okay, we'll give you that freedom just to be by yourself for a while. And then, after a while, you come back again. Now, when it's time, when it's ready. Because that's part of the spiritual path. There are times when you just, you know, you just are by yourself. You're very happy by yourself. And it's not as if that you are avoiding your friends because you don't like them. It's not an aversion to company. It's more like a pleasure for solitude. So it's not a negative thing. It's an attractive thing, a positive thing. So you don't, it's not like having friends is a burden. It's just like solitude is better. Like peace, being by oneself. That's not a bad thing to have, that solitude. If you really know how to enjoy solitude, what you're actually enjoying is enjoying your own company. You're at peace with yourself. You're friends with yourself. You're friends with whatever's happening. And if you can do that, you can also be friends with others as well. So you learn that friendship, you learn that acceptance, you learn that peace with yourself. And you know what I was saying this morning about you watching the present moment, you're at peace with that. You're happy with that. That's your best friend now, whatever it is. And if you can have your best friend as the present moment, you'll find that you won't go wandering off here and there. You won't go thinking about things or planning or wondering when the next meal is going to come. I got used to it. It's a long time before you get your next meal. That's a waste of time thinking about it. So instead of that, we're just happy in this present moment. It is our best friend. And those are the real friends you should hang out with. Things like present moment, peace, freedom, joy. So that's your real friend. So in solitude, it's not as if you are avoiding your friends. You're just avoiding the fake friends. And you're hanging out with the real friends, the good friends. The Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. The Dhamma, the truth, peace, freedom. So, when you're on this retreat, you're just hanging out with your best friends. And so that's quite natural. You want to be with those things, those people, or those states of mind which give you the most peace, happiness and joy. So it's not really a social problem. Don't get sucked into what the world says what you should do. You know, and sometimes it's a case that people, sometimes they don't understand that why you don't want to go out to a party, why you don't want to go out to the pub, why you don't want to go out to a meal, why you don't want to go and see a movie. Sometimes they can't understand that. And if they can't understand it, tell them to go to the Buddhist Center or go to our internet site, listen to a few talks, and they'll understand why. You save a lot of money that way too. Any questions on that one? It's going to be a short evening. I'll try and spin it out a bit longer. Ajahn Brahm, this retreat seems like control freak heaven. Sit, walk, eat, sleep, always the same. And the monks and nuns are even more controlled. How can it be possible that all this control shows us how to let go of control? Signed, I don't get it. Okay. Okay, it's amazing sometimes what looks like freedom is just very much in prison, and what looks like prison looks like freedom. I go and pass these houses and you see they've got all these security screens on them. You wonder actually who's in prison and actually who is free. Because some of these houses, you see all these bars on the windows, it looks like it's a prison inside. And people are inside. And everyone else is outside, they're free. So who's actually free and who's actually in a prison? And here is like the control freak heaven. Sit, walk, eat, sleep. You've got to do something. If you're not sitting, you have to be walking. If you're not walking, you have to be laying down or standing. You can only do one of those four things. It's not controlling. The point is that we're not telling you when to sit, when to walk, when to eat, when to sleep. Oh, when to eat, yeah. But it's a lot of freedom there. The control is not the outside. The control is the inside. And look, I couldn't sit still if I was controlling it. You'd never be able to do it that way. So you try. And if you try the control way, the control freak way, then that is that, you know, well, at 4 o'clock in the morning you get up, 4:30 you start walking, 5 o'clock you sit for an hour, 6 o'clock you do the chanting, you have to do the chanting, 7 o'clock you know, you have your breakfast, 7:30 you do this, 8 o'clock you do that. That's what I mean by control freak. It's like having one of these guards overlooking you, like these SS guards or this US Marine in Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, always looking over you, pushing you this way and forcing you to do this way. The thing is, you're not forced to do anything here. You can sleep whenever you want in this retreat. If you want to, you can actually sleep all day for 9 days. I challenge you to try it. Just get up at 7 o'clock, have your breakfast and go back to bed. Set your alarm for 11 o'clock. Just drag yourself out of bed, have lunch, and go back to bed again until 7 o'clock the following morning. You just can't do it. But the point is, I give you the freedom. And if you still are controlling, and you think you have to sit now, you have to walk now, that program out there is just a guideline. It's, don't keep it. I think you've probably noticed already, I haven't kept that guideline already. I've broken it many times, and I did it on purpose, because when it's time to walk, I like walking. I don't look at the clock. When it's time to finish, I just finish. When it's time to sit meditation, just sit. And when you feel it's time to come out of the sitting meditation, just do it. So this is not the controlling. This is allowing it to flow. Now, taking away the concept of time, taking away the concept of somebody, you know, overlooking and judging. So it's not a control freak heaven. If this was control freak heaven, I'd have a nice peak cap and I'd be striding up and down between you with a big stick like in the Zen tradition. And that's not the way to do it. So this is actually freeing you to allow you to meditate in your own time, in your own way. This is actually real freedom. To be able to let go. To stop that thing inside of us which always wants to judge and to make it happen this way and that way. So keep on sleeping, whoever wrote this. Just eating. See if you can just learn how to let go more and more and more and more. But let go of that thing inside is always judging, is always complaining, is always controlling. And then imagine yourself just floating through this retreat. Not worrying about the days, just being here in every moment, enjoying every moment, embracing every moment. And when there's no perception left of the future, how can you control at all? You know, you're just sitting, you've got to be doing something. So you're just sitting there and just see what happens. You're not expecting, you're not trying to get somewhere. All meditation is not trying to get somewhere, it's to be more fully where one is now. To be more fully in the present, not to try and attain something, but trying to let go of lots and lots of things. So one understands what meditation is, to be more fully in the present, not to try and get somewhere in the future. To be able to see if one can let go of things rather than gain things. Then one understands that it's actually the opposite of controlling. Once one gets that idea, you do actually get it, meditation is so easy, and it becomes very successful. But until one understands that, meditation always tends to be a problem for you. For those of you who haven't heard this story, I was telling this about 3 months ago very often. This was that story, Six Rains retreat in this perfect monastery in the north of Thailand. And I was having a wonderful time in this monastery because I was in solitude. No one else was there. 3 months to myself. It was absolutely perfect in a nice valley. Up in the mountains, really cool weather, perfect food. No one was bothering me at all. They just put food in my bowl and they just leave me alone for the rest of the day. So I had like 23 and a half hours all by myself. Absolutely wonderful. And first couple of weeks were fine. After two or three weeks, I started getting restless. And after about a month, it really was getting out of hand. My restless mind was starting to think of all sorts of what I call unmonkish thoughts. The problem was that there was no other monk or teacher I could go to. And it was getting worse and worse and worse. Romance, fantasy, sex, you name it, I was thinking about it. And so out of desperation, I went to the main Buddhist statue in the hall, bowed three times and asked for some help. I was going crazy with my restless mind. And the idea which came to me was to do a deal with my mind. And the deal was this. For 23 hours of the day, I'd watch my breath. But if the mind wanted to think of sex, romance, fantasy, science fiction, whatever it wanted to think about, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every day, you could. That's my free time. The mind can just go, if it really wants to, do it then, and leave me alone for the rest of the day. So that was the deal. And so I struggled again. It didn't work. Even though I made that deal, it was just still so hard to watch my breath and to be still. My mind was still really restless. But when it got to 3 p.m., I went to my hut, leant against the wall, put my feet out because I was just really sore from sitting meditation for so long. And I said, right mind, whatever you want to do, anything goes. Sex, movies, music, whatever you want to think about, go for it. And for the next hour, it was the most peaceful hour of the day, just watching the breath, every in breath, out breath, without losing one. It was just so easy. And I learned a great it's true, it happened. I learned a great lesson from that. Why was my mind being so restless? And why, when I tried to stop it, it got worse? Because that controlling was feeding the restlessness. The more I tried to control it, the more I was giving it energy. As soon as I let it go, you do what you want. It stopped. Just what I said yesterday, you hold your cup, you try and make it still, it just gets more movement. You say, oh, you do whatever you want, cup. Put it down, it becomes still by itself. So that's the difference. This is controlling. It's trying to stop your mind. You let it go. It's opposite of controlling, and everything becomes still. If you are a control freak, you'll have a very difficult time in this meditation retreat. You'll find you never have any peace and stillness. But I'm giving you lots of encouragement to let go, renounce that controller. And if you do, you find everything is just so easy. Meditation just flows and it gets so lovely. This is what happens when people do have their wonderful meditations on these 9-day retreats. They come up and say, oh, it's just so easy. And then they try and do it again next time. And they can't because they try to do it rather than remembering that they never expected anything. They let go, they relaxed and allowed it to happen. They got out of the way. So this is how it works. Sit there, disengage, put down your cup, and everything gets still all by itself. Once you experience those still states of mind, or just experience it once, you understand that this is the opposite of control. You understand what this letting go truly means. So this is what we mean. You're letting go of things. You're not controlling. Okay, anyone? Any comments about that? Okay, like even being like a monk, sometimes people, oh, all those rules you have to keep. That must be you're really control freak. You can't eat this at this time. You can't do that at that time. You're just the biggest... Why don't you just let go, Ajahn Brahm, and just have a glass of beer in the evening? And of course, that's not letting go. That's more controlling. It's just being a prisoner of your likes and dislikes, of your desires. When you really let go, you just don't care about these things. They just don't come up into your mind. Dear Ajahn, if, as you say, one must get out of the way and allow meditation to just happen, where does effort come into this equation? Yes, a great question. The effort is the effort to know, to observe, not the effort to do. So there's different types of efforts there. A lot of times we only know the effort to control, to do things, to make it happen. We never really understand the effort just to know, to observe. To put the effort just to observe what's going on. To be fully alert, fully awake. It's the effort of the paparazzi who wants to take the photo of Kylie Minogue, what I said yesterday. Or the effort of the person who wants you to take a photograph of your husband when he's, you know, canoodling somewhere where we shouldn't. And this is a private detective. Or the effort of, you know, to be very silent, to see without interfering with things. Or the effort of the wildlife photographer who wants to take a photo of like a tiger or an elephant in the wild. That's the effort which we have, the effort to know without doing things. And that sort of effort does not come from you. It doesn't come from a sense of self and me controlling things. It actually is an effort which rises naturally. And this is again one of those amazing things which you shall experience, you will experience in all likelihood in this retreat. The less you do, the more energy you have. All this doing business and the striving, that type of effort just wears you out. You get tired and dull. And it's why that I said, I think yesterday or this morning, you don't expect much of the first days of this retreat. It's not just physically tired, some of you are physically tired, but just about all of you are mentally tired. Just the mind has been doing so much, thinking so much, planning so much, it's been moving so much, your mind will be tired. And I'm asking you just to let it go, leave it alone, let it rest. And after a while, when the mind gets its rest, it starts to become energized again. You feel awake, you feel happy. That's why resting the mind is very important in the first couple of days of this retreat. It's tired because we've been doing so much. And as I mentioned, I think this morning, the energy of your being can go into two places, the doer or the knower. It goes into doing things, which means thinking, moving, planning, all that sort of doing stuff. You get tired. Because there's not enough energy left for pure knowing. Pure knowing means just being able to observe without judging, without changing, with no likes or dislikes. Just to observe and embrace that observation with a sense of equanimity or even with joy. Not doing anything, just watching. And once the energy starts to go into just knowing, just knowing, just knowing, that's when the mind really brightens up. And you get incredibly energized. That's why very often is those occasions on retreats such as this, you have a really nice meditation. It's just like you've had 3 cups of coffee. You just don't feel like sleeping. Sometimes in the evening people have these great meditations and they just can't sleep for the next couple of days. You're just so energized. Where's that energy come from? It's always been there, but you're not wasting it now. It's just going straight into the knowing. Then you have the energy, what effort is supposed to bring up, is like this energy, this power. And this comes naturally. And you feel that sometimes you could do all sorts of things. You're really empowered. And your mindfulness becomes very strong and powerful. And that's why you can start looking out and see like a blade of grass. And it just is brilliant in its greenness. Because you see every part of that blade of grass. Your mindfulness has been empowered. What I call superpower mindfulness. Many people have that experience when they're on these retreats. You just look at a brick on the wall, wow, look at that brick. That's amazing. Look what's going on in that brick. Wow. I'm not saying you're going crazy, it's just the mindfulness gets so strong you can see 100 times more than your ordinary eye can see. And this is just the power going into the mind. And that's what the effort is supposed to be. The effort is supposed to make you fit and energized and healthy and strong. But the effort in meditation, which many people do, just gives them a headache. It's wrong effort. So the right effort here is the effort to know without doing anything. To be here without going anywhere.
That's the right effort. That's subtle. It's difficult. But once you get to understand it, you understand what I mean through your own experience, and the meditation just flows. That makes sense. Okay, somebody does. So it is, as you get out of the way, the doer gets out of the way. When I say get out of the way, the knower has to stay there. But the doer, which is the main part of you, has to disappear. Next question, I've got two more. If we spend so much time watching the breath, then when we die and we lose the breath, what should we do instead? That's a great question. Has anybody got any plans? When I say looking for the future, I meant just not even think about your next meal, let alone your death. Okay, when you do die, why not die now? What is death anyway? Death is when you can't do anything anymore. You're just lying down there, just like a log. How about dying right now? You sit here and you give up all your will to do things. Give up your body. Give up your five senses. So all seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, all physical touch just disappears. Dying in the here and now is called the deep meditation of jhana. That's why when sometimes people get in these deep meditations, it looks like they're dead. You can't see them breathing. And they look so still. Sometimes you can't tell the difference. But fortunately, I'm here. So if I see you in that state, I will not send you to the undertakers. We will not ring up your parents and say, I'm very, very sorry, but I mean, your daughter, your son is now dead. You're perfectly safe. Because there was this one story of this in the time of the Buddha. This one guy, this one monk, he was meditating. He used to get these really deep meditations. He was obviously in a very, very deep jhana. And he was in the forest, and there's a couple of villagers were going past. Now, off to do some work early in the morning, and they saw this monk sitting there. So still, they couldn't see him breathing, they couldn't see him moving. They thought, oh, the fellow's dead. And they were Buddhists, disciples of the Buddha. So I thought, it's not right to leave like a dead monk just sitting there, because he might get eaten by the jungle animals. And that's not a very respectful way to die, or to actually to dispose of your body. So being Buddhists, they thought the only proper thing to do is give the guy a proper funeral. So they got some wood from the forest. They're right there in the forest, didn't take them a few minutes. Made a funeral pyre, respectfully put the monk on top, and lit it. And once the fire was well established, according to the story, they had busy people to do, they'd done their duties, so they went off to do their work. And so they left the monk burning on top of the funeral pyre. And you could imagine their surprise the following morning when the monk just walked into the village for alms food. Not even his robe was burnt, they say. Fascinating. So if you do get taken off to the funeral parlour, according to the legend anyway, they may even take you to the crematorium. They may put you in the oven, but you come out just as you went in. That'd be something, wouldn't it, for the newspapers? Anyway, we're talking about dying. So you spend so much time watching the breath, then we die and we lose the breath. What should we do instead? Now, I did sort of mention this morning, and I'll mention in greater detail later on during this retreat, watching the breath is only part of the meditation. It's a stage of the meditation. You start watching the breath, and the breath fills the mind, and it's just so easy. You're not controlling the breath. Just the breath is just there, easily. And the breath becomes just so nice and so beautiful. It's a stage called the beautiful breath. You stay like that for many, many minutes, just the breath going in, the breath going out. It's so pleasant, you don't want to do anything else. That's why you stay there, because the joy is what holds your attention. And then the breath disappears. It disappears naturally. You don't let go of the breath or decide to discard it. It just disappears. You're left with the beauty, the sense of joy. You're just very happy and very still. And the next thing you know, this beautiful nimitta arises in front of your mind. The reflection of the mind. When the nimitta arises, you're not aware of the breath at all. You can't feel the breath. You've gone beyond that. In fact, at that time, you can't feel anything of the body, nor can you hear. So whatever somebody rings the bell and says it's time for lunch, you just can't hear that. And you can't feel the body. Someone opens the window or closes the window, it's hot, it's cold, you just don't feel that anymore. Because your five senses of seeing, smelling, tasting and touching have been turned off. You're in the mind. Now, what is the difference between that and dying? Because when you die, your five senses get turned off. Sight, smell, taste, and touch, hearing as well, all go. That's called death. And when you die, you float out of your body and you see this beautiful light. It's exactly the same as what you experience, only slightly different, but the same phenomena. That light you see in near-death experiences is no different than the nimitta. It's a reflection of your mind. Your mind's been released from the body. So actually, when you practice this meditation, you're actually practicing how to die. You're having a dress rehearsal. So it's wonderful. When you get into these deep states of meditation, you know exactly what it feels like. You know what happens. People have near-death experiences, and I talk about them a lot, and it's amazing just how many people come up after and say, thank you for saying that, because I had this experience, I had that experience. I gave a funeral service last Wednesday, I think it was, and somebody came up afterwards actually to say, ah, yeah, that wasn't last Wednesday, it was last Monday or something. Anyway, not such a long time ago, anyway. And they came up afterwards to say, yeah, that happened to me. Motorbike accident, I cut my leg, hyperventilating, next thing I knew, floating out of my body. So peaceful, so nice. When the five senses disappear and you let go of your body, it's very, very pleasant. I don't think they saw the light, they had to came back immediately. But sometimes people do see that beautiful light. And that's the same as you see in meditation, the nimitta. So you're learning how to die. So you start with the breath, just to focus on something like a halfway house between the whole body and no body at all. Just the breath. And then you let go of the breath. It happens naturally. And you experience what it's like to die. And let me tell you, you've done it many times. If you can only remember, it's not that bad at all. So I think it's really got a bad reputation. Death needs a PR job. And that saying I was saying the other day was, my favourite saying for the last month is that good health is only the slowest way of dying. Who wants to be healthy? Just putting off the inevitable. Any questions about that? So actually, you're actually learning how to die here. You just watch the breath for the time being. That's what stage of meditation. It's not the whole meditation. When you die, just let go. Don't do anything. Don't control the body. So you can just float and flow. No attachment. Is there any such thing as unconditional thinking? Please explain. Thank you. Blessing of the Triple Gem. Unconditional thinking. The only unconditional thinking there is no thinking. Because all thinking is conditioned. It's amazing, just why do you think in that particular way and not other ways? I've noticed all my thoughts are all conditioned. You can actually trace where they come from. Some of these thoughts come from Ajahn Chah, some come from the Buddha's teachings, some come from my father. All the bad jokes all come from my father. He used to tell terrible jokes. So I know where they came from. It's just conditioning, that's all. Because early years of your life, what you're exposed to has an enormous imprinting effect on you. So if you don't like my jokes, I'm sorry, it's nothing to do with me. If you want to complain to anyone, you complain to my father, but now he's now dead, so you can't do much about that. But all thinking is conditioned. And when you actually know that, you don't believe in thinking anymore. Actually, I think that was in philosophy in the last 20 years. I forget who proved that. Proved that all thoughts are conditioned, so that now all theories are conditioned. There's no absolute theory. You cannot go to an a priori sort of condition and prove it's true. What actually was saying, I forget which philosopher it was saying basically you can't prove anything. You can't even prove that you can't prove anything. So in the end, the philosophy just goes in this black hole and just dies. So that's the thing, all thinking, all of your thoughts, it's only just one way of looking at it. Completely conditioned. It's only partial truth, like the story of the blind man and the elephant, which you all know. You all have your own experience of the elephant. You cannot have the full picture. That's why all thinking misses the point. That's why when you understand that, we stop valuing thinking. We value silence much more. In silence, you know. In thinking, you're just trying to give it some explanation. That's why go on. Are you thinking again?
Is there any difference between thinking and defilement?
And defilement, not really. It's all restlessness. Because, look, when I went on, I did a 6-month silent retreat some years ago. When you're on a 6-month silent retreat and you get into some deep meditation, it's hard to think. You just stay in silence all day. And it got to the point and I had to come out of that retreat and I had to start talking again. And to be able to talk, you have to think first. In silence, it's just the words don't come out. And it was true, I had a headache for 3 days and I had to force my brain to think again. It's lovely not thinking. You can know without giving it a name, without giving it words, without having a conversation about things. And there'll be times in this retreat when the mind goes silent, there's not a thought there. When a thought does come up, you think just how gross and coarse this is, these thoughts and these words, and how inadequate they are to explain what you're experiencing. And when you have these deep experiences, how can I explain that? And sometimes you come in the interviews and you just, wow, it's really nice, can't explain it. So you don't have to explain it. Just know it, that's good enough. So this is why the thoughts are all conditioned. They're not necessary. Unfortunately, that maybe when you were a young kid at school, maybe you had this great ability to be a meditator. And the teacher asked you a question and said, what did you think about that? And you said nothing. And you got into big trouble. And from that time on, you weren't encouraged to be silent anymore. You always had to think to get on in life in school. If I was a school teacher and a kid said, they thought nothing about it, I thought, great, come and ordain. You can be a monk, a nun. You've got great potential as a meditator. The great non-thinkers of the world. The thinkers create all the problems in life. Those who are silent, they're the ones who see the truth. So one of the methods in meditation is that if you have a very restless mind, which you can't stop thinking, ask yourself, why can't I stop thinking? And the reason is because you value the thoughts too much. You assume that those thoughts are going to lead you to some solution to your problems. That thinking them through, you'll get to some solution. But how many times have you thought through problems? And how many times have you found real solutions? 0 times. They're always partial solutions, that's all. I think it's about time that people understood that thinking just gets you to contrary ends. It never really solves the problem. But silence is where we can see more deeply and more further. In that silence, we can feel, we can know. And our knowledge is far more accurate in silence than it is through thoughts. If we could only realise that, we wouldn't think so much. We'd only think when we had to. And at other times, we'd be silent and at peace with the world and with ourselves. All thinking is just judging, just approximations. But we take those approximations to be real truth, and that's where we get into trouble. So let go of all this thinking and just listen to life, feel it, see it, see the real thing rather than the commentary. Once you can do that, you understand the beauty of peace. Another simile which I used to give is a simile of watching, there's a few Sri Lankans here, a cricket match on the TV. It might be Sri Lanka playing Australia. And if you have a Sri Lankan commentator, the Australian is bowling, that is not LBW. The Australian commentator, yes it is. Which one is true? Of course, we're always biased. We support one side. We always do that. And that's why our thoughts are always biased. So I say, if you're going to watch a cricket match or a tennis match, turn off the commentary. And just to see the thing in itself, in silence. And then you'll see much deeper, you'll see more. Some years ago, I was travelling on an aircraft, and they had this movie on the screen. Didn't take the headphones, but I remember the movie, it was Armageddon. And it's amazing watching a movie without the headphones. Try it once. It was so funny. It was one of the funniest things I'd seen for years. Because when you haven't got the headphones, you haven't got the music, which is playing with your emotions and making you see it this way and that way. And some crazy things happened on there. The one thing which really got me cracking up, I was very lucky they didn't think I was going crazy and chuck me off the plane, or was when, I think there's this spaceship or space shuttle or something, they're trying to, if I remember, I just can piece it together pretty easily. I think there was a meteor or a comet was threatening the Earth, and they went up in a spacecraft to try and sort of blow up the meteor, the comet. And I think they landed on it, and the spacecraft made a crash landing. There was flames and sparks everywhere, explosions all over the place. About 5 minutes. No one would ever survive that in a million years. But after all the explosions, all the fireworks finished, at the bottom of the screen, this little hand came up. And the hero, I forget who it was, and the Bruce Willis, I don't forget who it was, and the hero came up and he pulled himself up. And not a scratch. His hair was perm, just like it was before. No sweat, no marks at all on his face. It was just completely ridiculous. If you actually listen to the movie, I suppose, and listening to the soundtrack, you probably sort of think, isn't that really wonderful? But when you just stand back, you don't have the commentary. It was so hilarious. I just gave a big belly laugh when I saw that. I couldn't stop laughing. And that's what happens. You take away the commentary to life and you see it as it truly is. And what's the big deal? So, if you close your ears when you're listening to a marriage ceremony, for example, you probably burst out laughing. People dressed in all these fancy clothes. Apparently the bride is supposed to wear white as a sign of her purity. White is a sign of purity. It makes you wonder why the groom has to wear black. Okay, less said about that the better. Okay, so this is where we stop thinking. So all thought is conditioned. All thinking is basically a waste of time, especially in a retreat, so don't think about it, just do it. Any other questions on that?
There was something about thinking actually is helping to stop to think that I found myself today having quite a lot of thoughts and then looking to give myself this something like, let go, just be.
Yeah. Well, sometimes a little bit can sort of help, but just not too much, because otherwise you end up saying, let go, come on, let go, come on, let go, come on, let go. And this is always somebody talking. It's like that old joke about the four monks trying to keep silent. One of them sneezed. So the first one said, no, Gesundheit. The second one said, you've broken your vow of silence. The third one said, so have you. The fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. The point being that, you know, as soon as you say something, you're also making noise. So if you say, be quiet, you're not being quiet. If you say, let go, you're not letting go. The words and the thing are very different. So after a while, you just stop. Pull the plug on thought. Don't even think. I just stop thinking. Just let the whole lot go. Yeah, you had a question, Tom?
I think part of the problem is there's a discursive mind sort of thinking which goes all over the place, and the same process, the same word is used for let's think how to get to Nulla Mara, which is only a practicality. You pull out the UVD and think about getting to Nulla Mara, so you're actually taking the steps.
Yeah, it's true that sometimes in your life you have to think. I'm not saying that when you sort of you leave this retreat you're just a bunch of zombies and you just go down the street without thinking. But in this retreat you don't have to think. Or think very, very little. And that's wonderful to be able to do that. But, you know, there is this thing called like the train of thought, which is directed thought. And what you say is very true. Most of our thought is not directed at all. But be careful. Because what happens in meditation, this is one of the obstacles, comes up much later in meditation. Sometimes your mind gets so still and powerful in the sort of the deep stages of meditation, usually around the time when you can get a nimitta coming up. If you wanted to think about something, you have this enormous power. You can take a train of thought, you can focus it, and your thinking process is very penetrating. That stage of samadhi, meditation, if you've got a problem, you can work it out very quickly. You can think of the amazing parts of like Buddhism or Dharma teachings. But the Buddha said, don't do that. He said, even though you can, you're missing the point. You're so close to the deep state of stillness. You're just trading in what should come next to this just ability to think clearly and to think powerfully. So no thinking is even better. So even the most powerful ability to think, and you do get this just before you get into samadhi, is so powerful. You can really think very deeply and keep one train of thought for half an hour, so easy to do. The Buddha said, you're wasting a precious opportunity there, don't do it. You come across that later on. There were times in your meditation, if you want to think about anything in the Dhamma or anything about your life, your thinking gets so easy and so deep and so straight. But the Buddha is actually saying, warned you about that, be careful. Okay, the last question tonight. In his book Food for the Heart, Ajahn Chah said something like, some people find it hard to gain samadhi, however they can attain peace through developing wisdom by contemplating the truth of things. Please explain. Okay. Some people find it hard to gain samadhi, however they can attain peace through developing wisdom by contemplating the truth of things. Okay. Sometimes, if you can't attain samadhi, you can actually gain peace instead. Actually, they're the same thing. But if you can't, if you've tried meditation before and you can't get it, we use these little tricks, we give it a different name and see if you can attain that. So if you can't meditate, well, let's try doing just being quiet instead. It's exactly the same, but we're using psychology, because if you think, I can't do this meditation, I can't do this meditation, I can't do this meditation, then that's a psychological barrier. Because you think you can't, you won't. It's just your belief. It's like a person, if they cannot do breath meditation, then I'll teach them Anapanasati instead. You get the point? I said, no, this is Anapana, it's not breath meditation, Anapanasati. That Anapanasati is the Pali name for breath meditation, if you don't know that. What we really mean there is that it's just by giving it a different spin, people can actually find they can do it. So it's the same as if, like, someone, a kid can't do maths. So we don't do maths, we'll just do sums instead. And all it's doing is taking away that psychological barrier. I can't do this. The point is, with meditation, anybody can do meditation. Anyone can gain samadhi. And it's the job of a coach to try and convince you you can do it. And if I can convince you, yes, you can do it, then it works. You can do it. Many, many years ago, this disciple told me this story that for years he was trying to do the breath meditation. He just could not do it. Now watch the breath. Tried watching the breath going in, going out. Start thinking about something within a few seconds. So he got this teaching. Never told me who it was, but it was a brilliant bit of teaching. And this teacher came along and said, look, don't try and watch the breath then. If you can't do it, don't try. But just imagine you can watch the breath. Close your eyes, imagine what it's like to be able to watch the breath. Imagine what it's like just to be able to watch the breath for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. And so he's often imagining you can watch the breath. And then the teacher interjected, what are you watching? And he had to admit, the breath. Just imagining became the truth for him. He started off by imagining he watched the breath, and actually he was doing exactly the same thing as watching the breath. All the teacher was doing was bypassing the psychological block, I can't do it. And you can try that in your meditation. If you can't get jhana, imagine you're in jhana. Imagine you're doing. Imagine you're sitting here with your eyes closed. Imagine you're just watching the breath go in, go out, go in. Imagine the breath getting so beautiful, so nice. Imagine the mind just staying. Imagine the mind not thinking about anything at all. Just being with this beautiful breath going in. Imagine everything disappearing. Imagine it. The whole world disappearing. This beautiful light coming in the mind. This beautiful radiant light. Can you see a light? You see, there's a lot of truth in this. A little bit of imagination that actually starts to get you going. It brings up the seed. It's as if I can do it, and you do it. And that's the skill of a great teacher. It encourages you to do things which you thought you could never do. So if you can't be peaceful, imagine you're peaceful, and then you are peaceful. That's a psychological block, and that's the way it's overcome. So this is why Ajahn Chah, I think what he was saying here, you find it hard against samadhi because they're trying it wrong, just try and be peaceful. Same thing, because samadhi is peace. Samadhi, what samadhi means, is stages of letting go. When you let go of things, you become still. You're letting go of that thing, stopping the stillness. What Ajahn Chah used to say is, your mind is like a leaf on a tree, like all those leaves outside. They're absolutely still because there's no wind blowing. Oh, there's a little bit of wind blowing now. I can see it move slightly. Once that wind stops, all those leaves will be absolutely still. Because it's the nature of leaves to be still. So all you need to do is stop the wind. Stillness comes by itself. The nature of the mind to be still. You are the wind, you're the blower. This is why, to be able to become into samadhi, you just stop the wind, that's all. That's called peace. Peace is samadhi. Samadhi is peace. So if you can't do it one way, you just do it exactly the same way, giving a different name, and people can do it. So contemplating the truth of things. The truth is only silence. So eventually, contemplating. Well, contemplating doesn't mean thinking about it. Contemplating means holding up in front of you and allowing the mind just to watch it, to observe it without judging it. It's like the contemplating, which the word which the Ajahn Chah was using is very similar to a scientist when they gather the data from an experiment. A good scientist, when you're gathering the data, does not make any judgments at all about the data they're writing down. You don't sort of not liking the data, not averse to the data, because if it's something you like, you'll underline it. Something you don't like, you'll forget about it. You'll actually push it out. You won't accept it into the data pool. You have to be equanimous, no vested interest. Just gather the data silently. Only after all the data is in do you make your conclusions, you start judging. This is actually how we gather the data. So, contemplating things is just gathering the data of life in silence. It is the same as peace. Contemplating here is not thinking, it's observing. Observing silently for long enough to get enough data to understand the truth of things. So the silence is the same as samadhi, and the samadhi is the same as silence. Okay, any comments or questions about what I've been saying so far? Or any other questions? Hold a second, how much time? Actually, amazing. It's only 7 questions, but it's almost 9 o'clock already. So I did actually manage to spit out 7 questions for the whole hour. Very good. Any other comments or questions before we finish off? Going. Gone. Okay, so we finish off now. Thank you for asking those questions. Again, the time now is now o'clock. Not 9 o'clock, now o'clock. The time is now. So if I say it's 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, you think 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock is my bedtime. But don't think like that. If you've got energy and peace, carry on meditating. If you're really tired, who cares what time it is, go and take a rest. No control freak. Just allow yourself just to flow with the body. And if you're having a nice time, carry on meditating. And see if you can try and take away your interest in thinking and just know without thinking. The effort to know, not to do, just to be in the moment and allow this process of meditation to happen. Allow the energy to go into the knower, not into the doer, and you become more energized, brighter, and see more deeply into things. And also you become happier as well. And a meditation will be very, very easy because you're not doing anything. When you do things, you always get frustrated. When you don't do anything, you're never disappointed. Okay, so off you go. Have a nice evening. The night is still young, so see what you can do. Remember, again, no talking. When you see the crucifix there, always remember the warning.